Hello there. So this is, I believe, the seventh episode in a series I've been doing about some of the ethical and philosophical issues arising from the coronavirus or COVID-19 pandemic. In this particular episode, I'm going to be talking about the topic of privacy and surveillance, particularly as it pertains to how we emerge from the crisis. So this is, I think, a really important topic because it seems to me, based on some of the plans out there for how we get back to some semblance of normality, many governments are suggesting that there will be an increased level of tracking and surveillance of the population. And of course, to many ethicists and philosophers, this raises alarm bells given the importance or significance of the value of privacy in modern life. So I'm joined for this particular conversation by Carissa Valise. Carissa is a research fellow at the Uhiro Center for Practical Ethics in Oxford and the Wellcome Center for Ethics in Humanities. Her research focuses on digital ethics and practical ethics, and she is the editor of the forthcoming Oxford Handbook of Digital Ethics, as well as two individually authored books, Privacy is Power, which will be published by Transworld, and The Ethics of Privacy, which is due to be published by Oxford University Press. And Carissa, as somebody who has thought very deeply and carefully about the issue of privacy in the digital age, and I think you see that thoughtfulness coming across in the conversation that I had with her. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to the conversation that I recorded with Carissa. I hope you enjoy. Okay, Carissa. So, I mean, one of the things that's become pretty obvious with the reaction response to the COVID-19 pandemic is that there is, you know, a sharpened debate about privacy and surveillance, particularly since surveillance seems to feature so heavily in how governments are controlling and responding to the crisis. And so I wanted to have a conversation about this and look at some of the ethical challenges that we'll face going forward. I wanted to start with a general question, though, quite an introductory question, which is, you know, why should we care about privacy and what's the value and importance of privacy in our lives?
In general, I think we should care about privacy because it protects us from abuses of power. And that goes for individual abuses of power, like maybe a neighbor or an enemy or somebody at work abusing your information and using it against you, but also abuses of power from governments and from institutions like companies and so on. Interestingly, though, I recently carried out a survey about why people care about privacy. And one of the things that surprised me was that people care about it instrumentally, yes. In particular, they care about it as a way to protect their finances and their accounts and keep themselves safe. But in second place, you know, from a list of maybe 10 concerns or so, the second one was that they care about privacy as a good in itself, above and beyond the consequences it might have. So I think we also care about privacy because there is this intuition that may be similar to something like bodily integrity. It's this kind of idea that you shouldn't touch people when they don't want to be touched, even if it doesn't have any bad consequences above and beyond that. And maybe it's because privacy is related to autonomy. So in a way, the more we are in control of our data, the more we are in control of our own lives indirectly. And that might be why we care about it, even when it is not apparent that it has bad consequences instrumentally, like a loss of money or a loss of prestige or reputation.
I mean, I think the link between privacy and autonomy seems intuitively in a way to be a strong one. But in many countries, when we look at the protection of privacy and privacy rights, they are usually defeasible or qualified in some way. You have to balance them against other kinds of interests and concerns, I guess, most obviously around public security and safety. I mean, how in general should we think about that balancing act and how important is privacy relative to these other goods and interests that we care about?
It is very common to think of privacy and other values as a zero-sum game, which means that the more you have of one, the less you have of the other. So one of the more common lately confrontations is between privacy and security. And the idea for many people is that if you want more security, for instance, from a threat such as terrorism, then you need to accept to have less privacy so that the government can surveil everyone and keep us safe. But in fact, it seems that such a confrontational framework might be misleading many times. more often than not, privacy actually helps us protect the rest of our rights rather than it being something that is a some kind of an opposite value. So I think it's becoming more and more clear how a lack of privacy is also making us unsafe. And in the same way, it's not always clear that a lack of privacy is going to help other values such as public health. And that is a big question in the context of coronavirus, and one that we shouldn't take for granted that the answer is going to be yes.
Yeah, look, I think we'll definitely come back to that. I mean, one other preliminary question here, since it does feature a lot in conversations about privacy, is the role of consent in kind of qualifying or modulating the way in which we protect our privacy. So what's your view in terms of whether consenting to a privacy intrusion or invasion is a valid way to kind of waive your right to privacy?
I feel quite torn about that. First, there are questions about what we mean by consent and what is meaningful consent. So we have problems, for instance, once the European GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, got implemented, it sounded like a very good idea, and I think it is. I think it's a fantastic success, but it has problems with regards to consent. And one of the problems is that you get all these pop-ups all the time asking for your consent, and people just want to look at the website and mostly don't even read it and just accept anything. Or if you actually engage with it many times, you don't actually get much information. It's very burdensome to tick no all the time, and it has other problems. So in that very clear example, it's not entirely obvious whether consent is helping us. Another problem with consent in the context of privacy, and especially big data, is that originally the concept of consent comes from medical ethics, and one of the important requirements for it is that consent should be informed, and that means that you should have a good idea of what are the risks that you're engaging in, what's going to happen to you, what are your options, and so on. And with regards to your data, that's very hard to, it's very hard to give informed consent. First, because these concepts are very abstract, and it's not easy for an ordinary person to understand how their data is, what kind of data is being collected, what kind of data can be inferred from that, and how it's going to be used. And second, because even the programmers themselves, or the people who are collecting the data, don't necessarily know where the data is going to end up and how it's going to be used in the future, and what kind of inferences can be uncovered that cannot be uncovered today, but maybe in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. And so it's very questionable whether that counts as informed consent, given so much uncertainty. And then a third big problem with privacy and consent is that sometimes it seems like we don't have the moral authority to consent to giving up our data in the same way that we have the moral authority to consent a medical intervention. And that is because our data includes data about other people. So suppose, you know, I want to know more about my genetic background and I perform one of these tests at home. And, you know, I'm asked for my consent, and let's suppose I inform myself really well and I have more or less an idea of what I'm signing up for. But it turns out that in so doing, I'm also exposing the privacy of my siblings, of my parents, of my children. And they're not being asked for permission to do that. And so in a way, it's not clear that my consenting has that kind of moral authority.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And that's also something that features, I think, in the conversation here around, you know, contact tracing in response to the coronavirus. So there's a lot of stuff happening at the moment around surveillance and concerns about privacy in response to the coronavirus. Maybe you could review some of the things that have been happening, some of the surveillance and data tracking efforts that are currently underway in response to COVID-19. I know there's a lot going on in different countries, but maybe an overview of some of the major developments in the past couple of months.
Yeah, sure. It's very hard to keep track of everything that's going on because so many people are working on this, and there are many apps in many different countries, and the apps differ a lot from each other, and every day there's something new. So this will probably be outdated quite soon. But some of the most important things that have been going on, the latest news is that Apple and Google have partnered up to create some kind of contact tracing app. Many of the details are still unclear because the app is still being designed, But a couple of the details that are important is that this app will be installed automatically in updates on the phone. So everybody who has an iPhone or an Android phone would have it. The original plan is for it to be voluntary in the sense that you have to activate it, or at least you could opt out. But there are concerns about whether that might change in the future and whether governments could require it. And it appears that it's going to use Bluetooth to try to ascertain whether two phones have been in contact with each other. But again, the details are still very much tentative, and we'll see what happens. And I think that app is probably going to be used in the US, and it's unclear whether it's going to be used in other countries. But other countries around the world have other apps and have been using them for quite a while now. So Israel, for instance, is using mobile data that it was already collecting for national security purposes. And this was interesting because it unveiled how much data Israel was already collecting. And they're mainly using GPS location. In Moscow, just today, there's a new digital tracking system to enforce the coronavirus lockdown. And it's mandatory from today, April 15th. So everybody who lives in Moscow, if they want to go out, they have to download a QR code, and they have to register on a government website or download an app on their smartphones, and they have to declare what they're going to do and where they're going to go and why. And then they receive this QR code that can be checked by the police. China was one of the first countries to use an app. It's voluntary, but you need to use it if you want to go out. So in that sense, it's voluntary in a way. But if you have to work or you have to go out for anything, you need it. So it's actually, it sounds more mandatory than voluntary. It's based on three colors. So the app gives you three colors, either green, that suggests that you are low risk and that you can move around. Yellow, that suggests you are medium risk and you should stay at home, or red, which suggests high risk and you should definitely stay at home for a quarantine. And these codes are used for anything related to moving around. So from going to one city to another, to entering different buildings or going to work. So, some of the anecdotal evidence that we're getting, or some of the stories that we're getting, are quite concerning in that people don't know how the app works or what kind of data the app is using. The app also sends this information straight to the police. And once you get, for instance, a red code, you're not sure when it's going to go away. For some people, it only lasts for a couple of weeks. For other people, it lasts a lot longer, and they're not sure why that happens. And there's no process of appeal or any kind of person who can explain or any kind of clarification. And like all apps, it has problems. So one person told the New York Times that their code was green, and then they just drove past Wuhan without stopping. And just because of driving, the code became red, and they had problems going to work. Another person had a chronic case of sniffles, and the code kept turning red, even though she was low risk. So those are some of the problems that can, or the cases that exemplify problems with the app. In South Korea, there have been various apps. The government provides some of the data, but the apps seem to be private. And some of these apps are very, very intrusive, very problematic from the point of view of privacy, because they release a lot of information about people. So for instance, when a person tests positive, their city or their district might send out an alert to people living nearby with the movements of that person before they became diagnosed. So an alert can contain the infected person's age, gender, a detailed log of their movements down to the minute. In some cases, it's been traced by using CCTV or credit card transactions, and the information might include the time and names of businesses they visited. In some districts, public information includes which rooms of a building the person was in, whether they visited the loo, whether or not they were wearing a mask, and even overnight stays at love motels have been noted. And one of the risks of disclosing so much information about an individual is that it might create a social stigma that might disincentivize people from actually getting tested.
Yeah, so I'll come back to that at the moment, because I think the kind of the public health rationale for using these is importantly linked, I think, to the testing regimes that are in place in different countries. But I just want to maybe pause for a moment to mention or ask another kind of set of questions about this. One is just that, like, so all of these examples here are to do with kind of surveillance and tracking for public health reasons. There's also, I think, another aspect to the debate at the moment, which we might return to maybe at the end of the conversation, which is just around other ways in which data is being collected as a result of changes in lifestyle habits and working habits as arising from the coronavirus. So with more remote work, for example, there's issues around privacy and security for video conferencing apps and services, which are a feature, I think, of the debate as well. But let's linger for the time being on the public health question. And I think that's a good kind of review of some of the apps and services that are being rolled out in different countries. Now, it seems to me that no matter how much we value privacy, the kinds of data tracking and surveillance that are taking place at the moment, I'm not saying that they're all legitimate, but there does seem to be maybe a strong rationale for doing it, and that it is kind of key to resolving this crisis and helping society return to some semblance of normality. The scientific evidence, as far as I gather, suggests that contact tracing and isolation of people is the long-term solution to this crisis, if we want society to kind of restore to some kind of equilibrium. And there's a paper in, I think it was Science or Nature at the end of last month, which suggests that digital contact tracing is sort of the solution to this. So, I mean, how do you think about that public health rationale? It seems like a strong ethical case can be made for tracking and surveillance in the present context. And doesn't that kind of trump a lot of the traditional concerns about privacy and surveillance?
I'm not entirely certain that it does. So yes, the paper was in Science, and it was a mathematical model suggesting that contact tracing might help. And mathematical models are very valuable, but they are mathematical models. They rely on many, many assumptions. And one of the things I worry about is that any app is bound to have too many false positives and false negatives. Every app has a problem. So for instance, suppose you use GPS to do contact tracing, which just means when somebody gets infected, you try to track down the person, the people who have been in contact with that person, to try to contain the virus and alert them that they might be high risk and that they should stay home and isolate themselves. So, okay, suppose you use GPS location. One of the problems with GPS is that it can't tell the difference between two different floors in the same building. So if somebody has been working at the building, many people will be contacted that shouldn't be contacted because they weren't in the same room with that person. They were only in the same building. In the same way, suppose we use Bluetooth, and Bluetooth is thought to be more privacy protecting because it doesn't record location. It just records whether two phones have been in proximity to each other. But it's very unclear what should count as a contact. So many apps are defining a contact according to, I think it's the suggestion by the World Health Organization. A contact counts as a contact if two people have been around 15 minutes next to each other and at a distance of about 2 meters from each other. But of course, you can see how that is a very rough approximate of whether contagion took place or not. You could have two people walking down the street and who know each other and who give each other a hug and a kiss, and that takes much less than 15 minutes, and they might spread the virus. Whereas you might have two people who seem very close to each other because of Bluetooth for 15 minutes, but in fact, there's a wall between them. And so you can see how all of the apps work through proxies. And the proxy, what we want to know is who is infected and who isn't. But the apps cannot substitute for a proper coronavirus test. So one of the things I'm arguing is that what we need is massive testing, much more than apps. And if we have massive testing, it's not entirely clear to me whether we need apps or whether we need the kinds of apps that are being designed.
So explain that to me. So, I mean, first of all, why is testing important? It seems like testing is anyway a precondition for any successful system of digital contact tracing, right? Because the only way the digital contact tracing system is going to be valid at all is if it is able to identify people who actually have the virus. But why do you think it's not necessary to have some kind of system of digital contact tracing if we have widespread testing?
So let's compare two cases, one in which we have very few tests and one in which we have a lot of tests. So one in which we have a very few tests, which is more or less the present case. So suppose we only test people who end up in the hospital. Somebody tests positive and then you have an app and you contact other people who have been in touch with that person. There are at least two problems with that. One is that it will contact a lot of people who shouldn't be contacted because they're not infected. And so you're not allowing those people to go out to work when they should go out and work and have a normal life because they're not infected. But even more concerning is that they won't contact a lot of people who are infected. So by the time somebody goes to the hospital and gets tested, they will have infected other people who in turn will have infected other people, and most of them will be asymptomatic. And now let's compare that case with one in which we have a lot of tests. Suppose that we develop a test it's something like a pregnancy test or like ovulation kits, and everybody has it and everybody can test themselves every morning. I mean, this is very exaggerated. We probably don't need that kind of massive testing, but just to make the point.
Just to briefly address, I think was it the Gates Foundation claimed that they could have these kinds of simple at-home tests as a way of doing this. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe it's not enough to do it every day for everyone, or I don't know. But just to make the point, in that case, we wouldn't need contact tracing at all because we know exactly who's infected and who's not.
Right, let me try and clarify my thoughts on this. So like on that second example, do we still need there to be some kind of data sharing around whether people have this or not, right? So we might need the app, but there still needs to be some kind of data sharing. Is that right?
Possibly, but not necessarily. So it depends. If you think that people are not responsible enough to carry on quarantine, then a positive test might trigger some kind of data sharing just to make sure that the people who are infected are staying in quarantine. But it would be nothing like contact tracing. Contact tracing would be completely unnecessary once we have a massive test. And so one of the things that I worry is that we have a tendency to think that tech is magic, that tech is going to solve our problems. And that's not necessarily the case. These are medical problems and we need medical solutions. And an app is not a medical solution in many ways. Furthermore, we tend to think of tech as it were in its most ideal circumstance, if everything works well. And the reality is that it doesn't. Many of the apps that I've been talking about are very glitchy, have many problems. So I just worry that we're kind of, we engage in a little bit of magical thinking when it comes to tech.
Yeah, I mean, I think two points in response to that, though. One is that, you know, medical tests also have false positives and error rates attached to them. And I guess it might be a question of which one is more error prone. I'm willing to believe that the digital contact tracing is more error prone, but you know, why would it not be a good thing to have kind of multiple solutions or multiple strategies in operation at once? And at least in the short term, isn't it a good thing to try and err on the side of excessive caution and maybe excessive false positives, because we want to try and stop the spread of this? And maybe it's more in the long term that we need to think about relaxing some of these measures or try and pay more attention to the errors that are being made by these different tests, either traditional medical tests or digital contact tests?
Yes, it's very important for the test to be reliable enough. And one of the reasons we don't have massive testing at the moment is because many of the tests are not reliable enough, or many of the quick tests are not reliable enough. But again, it seems to me that is absolutely the priority. And that if we don't have that, we are going to damage the economy quite gravely by asking so many people to stay home. And that also has health effects. So I think the two priorities are to stop the contagion, and that's, I think, the main priority. But a second close priority is to keep the economy as healthy as possible.
So, I mean, is your concern here that this is a moment that is kind of easy for... It's easily exploited, perhaps, by this kind of surveillance industry insofar as we're paying a heavy price for social distancing and lockdown measures at the moment. And so when faced with the costs that are being imposed by those public health measures, people might be willing to trade their privacy more, or governments might be willing to exercise more control and surveillance as a way, because they think it's a way of getting out of the crisis quickly. And so we should be exercising kind of heightened caution or scrutiny given the fact that this is a moment that's ripe for exploitation.
Yes, that's exactly my concern. I think it's very easy to give away privacy because it doesn't hurt, and the consequences, the bad consequences, are only seen a long time down the line, sometimes years. And tech is very good at promising things that it might not necessarily deliver. And it's an easy way of the government to show that it's doing something, that it's trying. So yes, I think it's a moment of great risk, and that we should be vigilant. And that doesn't mean that there is no space for apps. I think, you know, there could be an app that's very well designed, that's very respectful of privacy, that is based on evidence. But I think the standards should be very, very high.
Yeah, I mean, so that was the question I wanted to ask next, was just like, which, is there any form of digital contact tracing that you can think of that would be legitimate, that like the kinds of data collected would be acceptable? Or is this kind of just a question of imagining a technology that isn't currently feasible? Like, what's your view on that?
So some of the contact tracing apps seem to be possibly acceptable from the point of view of privacy, particularly those that use Bluetooth and that use hashing to protect people's privacy, and that they don't collect any kind of identifiable information. They only collect data regarding whether two phones have been in the same space, and then it gets deleted after 2 weeks and so on and so forth. But even then, it just seems to me that if we had a reliable test, it would be so much more effective, even just disregarding privacy entirely. What we want is to know whether somebody has been infected, and to have a reliable test is so much better than to have a contact tracing app that works through proxies.
Right. And so as far as I understand it, the Apple, Google proposal does have fairly strong cryptographic protections in it. At least that's the way it's being presented and kind of marketed or advertised at the moment, although it doesn't exist yet. I appreciate your argument here is that we need to focus on the testing, and that's really the solution to the problem, as opposed to these digital solutionist type approaches. That said, like, what is your view on opt-in versus opt-out when it comes to these systems? I think like one of the concerns that came up in Singapore, for example, with their contact tracing app was that not enough people actually opted into it to make it useful. Some people have argued, is it Kansu Kanka has written this, I hope I'm getting her name right, this Medium article about why she thinks mandatory opt-in is essential as long as it's privacy protecting. Do you have any view on that argument?
I think the devil is in the details. It depends on how privacy protecting it is, how effective it is, and also how risky the virus is. So I think it depends on where we are. If, you know, somewhere like the UK or Spain right now seems pretty risky in terms of how likely somebody is to get infected if they go out and about or to infect others. But now some countries are controlling it quite well. For instance, Denmark is already thinking about relaxing its measures because the contagion has plummeted. And so that also matters. what's the risk we're talking about? And so it depends for each country, and it's changing day by day.
So if the main concern here is that there's a, we're at a moment that can be exploited, there's kind of a slippery slope concern.
Yes, I think that. Yes. That is the main concern.
So if that's the concern, I mean, are there any lessons from history here in terms of a danger of emergency responses that might violate privacy and other important values that not being rolled back? Is there anything we could learn from history with respect to this current crisis?
There are many examples, and one book that I remember really liking because it has so many good examples, though I read it a while ago, is Naomi Klein's Doctrine of Shock. And the whole book is about how governments and powerful corporations seize crises to amass more power and to pass laws and different measures that would never be accepted in a normal situation. One of the phrases that comes to mind at the moment was uttered by Barack Obama's chief of staff, whose name is, I can't remember at the moment, but he said something like, never allow a crisis to go to waste, because it's an opportunity to make things happen that you could never make otherwise. So for instance, in China, a couple of examples that have been mentioned recently are the 2008 Beijing Olympics and the 2010 World Expo in Shanghai, that were used to introduce new monitoring tools that never went away. And for the West, perhaps the closest and most vivid example is, of course, 9/11. After the terrorist attacks happened, a number of legislations regarding privacy were passed, both in the US and in Europe, many of which were secret, some of which weren't secret, and that were supposed to be extraordinary for an extraordinary moment, and that still haunt us to this day. Furthermore, every piece of evidence we have shows that such enhanced surveillance was utterly ineffective to curtail terrorism. So that's a very clear case of how we lost masses of privacy. In fact, the data economy wouldn't be what it is today were it not for 9/11. And in exchange, we had very little or nothing in terms of security, even though we were promised security.
So, I mean, like, what's the nightmare scenario for you coming out of this? Like, what could happen? What could go wrong in terms of the levels of surveillance and tracking that are justified for public health reasons that become permanent?
I think there are many levels of nightmare scenarios, some of which are more nightmarish than others. But so let's start low level. Having let's say in the UK, a big degree of surveillance now in collaboration with big tech companies like Palantir and Amazon. And that in the long run can, for instance, be bad for people because they will be discriminated against for insurance, discriminated against for employment, because big tech can have developments in algorithms that then get sold to the health system, extremely expensive, so that only rich people, or not at all, so that only rich people can access them. Privacy invasions cause all kinds of power asymmetries. So that's a kind of low-level bad effect in which our current power asymmetries just get enhanced and exaggerated more and more. And a more nightmarish scenario is one in which we walk towards a kind of society of control or some kind of police state, and certain kinds of limits to civil liberties get normalized and justified, and we get used to it. And that in turn might lead to other bad consequences, like in the 1930s to a comeback of fascism or authoritarianism or other kinds of authoritarianism and nationalism and so on.
Like, this is a question, this is maybe an unusual question, but it's something that I was thinking about myself, which is that in my kind of overview of the last, let's say, 20 years of the debate around privacy, is that there was a moment when people were arguing that we were moving into like a post-privacy society as a result of the rise of the digital economy and the internet, and then the spread of surveillance technology. And then there seemed to be a fairly significant pushback against that by academics and digital rights activists. And there have, at least in Europe, let's say, been some significant gains, I think, for privacy, particularly around the general data protection regulation. But now it seems maybe that we're at this kind of other moment where we're going to be pushed back in the other direction. Is that your reading of the recent history around privacy, or has it all just been kind of a slow and steady decline into less and less privacy protections?
No, I think you're completely right. That's my reading as well. And like all civil liberties, we never win them entirely forever. It's always a battle, and we always have to defend them. And there will always be pushes and powerful pressures on them. But one interesting thing is, I think that the digital in general made us forget for a while why privacy was important. And, you know, people like Zuckerberg in 2010 saying that we had evolved privacy, and big tech had an interest in us thinking that privacy wasn't important anymore. And another finding that we found with our survey that maybe we can link to in the podcast is that 92% of people have had a bad experience related to privacy online, whether it's exposure of some sort or having their identity stolen. And I think that's partly why people have been more privacy conscious. But the moment there is a threat and people feel afraid for their families, for their lives, for their countries, it's very easy to forget that lesson again. And there is one argument that is very powerful, and that is that, you know, we can save lives, and nobody wants to get in the way of saving lives. So rather than ask, but are we really saving lives, and being more critical, it's easier. And in some ways, I think it's an attempt to be a good citizen to just say, okay, yes.
Yeah, I think there's a strong sense at the moment of kind of social solidarity, in the sense that you have to contribute to the common good. And that's a positive thing. I think it's maybe a good development out of the crisis, but that is also something that can be exploited, as we were saying earlier in this conversation. I wanted to ask a question about the data economy. This is something that you were suggesting to me in advance, that, you know, it's more clear than ever that our use of the kind of technologies, digital technologies, is not entirely optional or voluntary, and that there's significant privacy problems around this. And this links back to something I mentioned earlier, which we haven't touched upon. We've been focusing on the kind of public health rationale for surveillance and tracking. But there's also clear at the moment, as more people work from home, that there's data being collected from that in ways that maybe didn't have equivalencies when they were going out to work. Certainly, let's say for some of my work, more information is being collected about things that I'm doing than would have been the case previously, particularly around the use of different video conferencing services. You know, how should we think about that aspect of what's happening at the moment? Not the public health side of things, but the data economy and the digital economy more generally. Is there more concern here about companies profiting from data in the current context? Is there a need for increased vigilance given the kind of social and economic changes that have been underway?
Yes, I mentioned this topic because I think it's another front that we have to fight and that we should neglect. And I think that the coronavirus is very interesting because it's changing things in ways that are very profound and that will probably have consequences in the long term once the epidemic has been conquered. So one of them is that we're working from home and we're using video conference a lot more. And while we might go back to going to our workplaces, maybe some of this will remain. And even if it doesn't, many tech companies are gaining much more power and much more money at the moment because we depend on them so desperately. And yeah, like you mentioned, I think that the crisis has made it more evident than ever, even though I think it was also true in the past, how we're not exactly voluntary in the use of these technologies. We have to work, we have to get food, we have to make sure that our kids are in school, and more it is required of us that we use technology. And in that way, I think that tech companies' duty towards us is higher, because we're captive audiences, we're sitting ducks, and governments have to ensure that their citizens are protected against possible abuse. And it's very easy to abuse us at the moment, because we need these tech companies to do what we are used to doing, and to communicate and to make the economy keep working. So I think it's very questionable right now whether tech companies like Zoom, for instance, should be profiting from people's data, when it's very clear that people are not happy with giving out that data, but they don't have a choice. And, you know, I mentioned Zoom in particular because of two reasons. One is that before the coronavirus, many people hadn't even heard of it or used it, and now everybody's using it. But also because it has had extremely bad reputation with regards to security and privacy. It has very bad practices. It has very bad security, both privacy and security practices, bad user configurations, and so on. So I think it's a moment to really push back and ask of companies that they up their game and that they treat us a lot more fairly than they're used to.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And I think there are other options out there in terms of video conferencing that are more privacy protecting. But what strikes me as interesting, and Zoom may have been structured in a way that can take advantage of this particular moment, is that Zoom has a level of convenience that people seem to find attractive. And, like, unfortunately, for many of the calls that I've been on, particularly, let's say, outside of my own organization, people have defaulted to that option. And yeah, I think it's probably a time to question whether we should default to that option just because it seems more convenient. Because in some sense, its openness and its convenience is a function or illustrative of its kind of lack of privacy protections.
That's absolutely true. There's Jitsi, there's FaceTime, there are many other better options. But I think, and I also think that the more power you have over others, the more responsibility you have to choose the right platform, because your employees might not feel empowered enough to ask for an alternative. Or, you know, if you're a school, then parents might not feel the liberty to ask for alternatives.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, the last topic I wanted to touch upon with you, this is kind of going back to public health questions, is there's a lot of discussion recently about the use of immunity passports as something that might allow people to return to work. Do you know, like, anything about that? I mean, what are the potential risks or concerns around the use of immunity passports?
Immunity passports are very interesting, because unlike contact tracing, it seems to me that the reason to be makes a lot more sense for health purposes, even if we had massive testing and even if we had better treatment. And the reason is that there are two main concerns in this pandemic: health and the economy. We want to avoid the disease and deaths that can result from contagion, and we want to keep our economies going, but without undermining our health. And both of those concerns get addressed by immunity passports, because they allow people who can work and are healthy and won't infect others to work, and they minimize the risk of contagion. But they're very concerning, because they do seem like a step in the direction of a society of control. And history teaches us that it's undesirable for governments to keep track of its citizens too closely. It leads to power asymmetries, and it's very tempting for power to abuse that asymmetry. And the main concern there is that to enforce it well would require serious intrusion in the lives of citizens, and with at least two bad consequences, but more, really. One is that social cohesion might suffer. There might be resentment from those who cannot go freely, and there might also be a normalization of this kind of police control. And with regards to health, there's the worry that it might cause an incentive for people to catch the virus, especially young people who might think themselves more maybe invulnerable, or people in difficult economic circumstances who need the income and who need to work. And I would find immunity passports particularly concerning if they were digital, because if we are forced to carry our phones around with us at all times, it's not only the immunity passport, it's also how much data can be gleaned from our phones. And in general, there's just a concern that the epidemic will exacerbate these inequalities and that people with immunity are going to have privileges. So we need to make sure that if we go that route, that people without immunity, especially underprivileged and people at high risk of getting the disease badly, will get other privileges. So for instance, suppose you test positive, and that means that you have to stay at home for 2 weeks. You should get support from the government in terms of funding, in terms of food, and so on. But yeah, immunity passports concern me because they do make sense. I have to admit that they do make sense. It makes sense to allow people to work when they can and to keep people who may be a risk for others at home for 2 or 3 weeks. On the plus side, I think it's a measure that it's more easily contained, that you only use for the epidemic and then that it goes away. I think with privacy, it's easier for those measures to stay for many reasons, but among others, that there will always be a risk of a possible epidemic. And in second place, because and a second reason is because privacy is very invisible in a way that an immunity passport isn't.
Yeah, I think it is a tricky issue, and there's a tricky balancing. As you say, there is a strong rationale for it. I would be concerned that it would be used more widely, so it's not just immunity to this particular disease, but there might be other kinds of immunity checks for other infectious diseases that are added to it over time. Yeah, so I think there are concerns about how that would be used if it gets used. Just on that, even though it's a less perfect solution to the problem, how do you feel about the idea of just, like, you know, simple temperature checks when you're entering buildings or large gatherings or things like that? Is that a less intrusive measure? I guess it depends on how it's actually implemented, again, whether it's a digital service that tracks information in some way. But I mean, in principle, is that a less problematic way of addressing how people get back out into the world?
In principle, it might be, but again, it depends on how it gets implemented, and it's so error prone. First, like, thermometers of the kind that are being used for this, the ones that are used on the forehead, are very imprecise, and one can have a temperature for all sorts of reasons. So they're far from perfect. And one of the difficulties of assessing which measures are best is that, suppose, you know, we examine a place like South Korea that has been quite successful in containing the virus. They have been using so many measures that it's very hard to separate what worked from what didn't and what is desirable from what it's not. So yes, they use apps, but they also used much more testing than the rest of countries. And so many people who are justifying apps are using the example of South Korea, when in fact it might have been the testing that did most of the legwork.
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a big problem with the kind of lessons that people are drawing from it or trying to learn based on different countries' responses, is that there's too many variables and too many factors to disentangle them. These aren't, like, perfect natural experiments at all. You even see that at the moment. There's a debate going on in Europe within kind of Scandinavian countries about the response of Sweden versus other countries. And Sweden seems to have, like, a higher death toll because it hasn't as many restrictions in place. At least that's the argument. But there's pushback against that amongst the kind of Swedish authorities, that you're not comparing like with like, that Norway isn't like Sweden and isn't like Denmark. And so these measures or these lessons that people are drawing are not justified on the data. So it's a very tricky question or tricky issue to resolve.
It's indeed super tricky. And I would like to add a couple of thoughts that are relevant to the whole conversation and that I think are important. One is, we should get our priorities straight. So the priority is to get a vaccine, get treatment, and get tests. Those are the medical things that we need, as well as getting more protective equipment, in particular for healthcare professionals. And those things have to come first. And only second, if they're helpful, will things like app and immunity passports might help. And you know, it's a big if. So let's get our priorities straight, and let's not allow these other things detract from our resources or our attention. So even, you know, for philosophers, immunity passports are much more interesting because they raise all kinds of issues and they're very extreme. And but we shouldn't detract from the importance of developing a vaccine and developing test and treatment, which may be philosophically less interesting because it's less controversial, but it's really much, much more important. And something related to this point is that we should be very mindful of the kind of context we're in. So imagine that this virus had happened in the 1950s. And when there's a big crisis, government asks big companies to help out. If the big companies had been, for example, producers of cars or big pharma, then their response would have been probably to produce more hand gels and more masks and more gloves and to develop physical products. But when this crisis strikes and we're in the middle of the digital age and the government asks big tech to help, what big tech has to offer is surveillance. And it's not necessarily the right answer. It may be more like hammers looking for nails situation than it just happens to be what we need. And the second point is that I don't want to make it seem as though, you know, there are these evil people in tech and government wanting to abuse the situation to get at our privacy. There might be some of that, but in fact, I think that is minor. The way power gets abused is much less clear, much more fuzzy. It happens over time. It's not always a case of bad intention, but rather good intentions that then get distorted with time. So, for instance, in the case of 9/11, I am very confident that there were people who wanted that kind of extra surveillance and power to keep people safe, and they really believed that it would help. And it was their job to do that. And it was our job to be critical and assess that situation fairly. So I don't think it's a case of like evil people lurking around wanting to exploit the situation or that is minor. The more important concern is that asymmetries of power lead to abuse in the long run, and that those kinds of unfairness and evilness in the system isn't necessarily a projection of evilness in individual people.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Those are two excellent points to bear in mind. And yeah, like I did mention earlier on that this is a moment that could be exploited, but I'm not suggesting that people are doing that out of evil intent. I mean, the reality is that most people, most of the time, like to think that they're acting for the best of reasons and out of the best of intentions. It's the unintended consequences of that when it's mixed up with other responses by other people and with institutions and systems that is problematic. In most cases, there are maybe some people who do act out of genuinely evil intent, but as you say, they're presumably a minority. Okay, I think that's probably a good place to leave it, and I think that was an excellent overview and analysis of the issues that are raised about privacy and surveillance and the importance of keeping them in perspective. So I'd like to thank you for joining me for this conversation, Carissa.
Thank you very much, John. That was very interesting.